Hello, hello, hello. Here's Malanka again, continuing with Sri Aurobindo's essays, Divine and Human. And we're in the midst of his writing called Original Thinking. So to begin, let me just take a second to reiterate the last sentence from last week. He tells us, in India alone, there is self-contained, dormant, the energy and the invincible spiritual individuality which can yet arise and break her own and the world's fetters. It is true that original thinking makes for original acting, and therefore a caution is necessary. We must be careful that our thinking is not only original, but thorough, before we even initiate action. To run away with an isolated original idea, or charmed with its newness and vigor, to ride it into the field of action, is to make of ourselves cranks and eccentrics. This world, this society, these nations and their civilizations are not simple existences, but complex and intricate, the result of a great organic growth in many centuries, sometimes in many millenniums. We should not deal with them after snatching at a few hurried generalizations or in the gust and fury of a stiff fanaticism. We must be sure that our new thought is wide and strong-winged enough, our thoughts large enough, our natures mighty enough to deal with those vastnesses. We must be careful, too, to comprehend what we destroy. And destroying we must not, unless we have a greater and more perfect thing to put in the place even of a crumbling and moldering antiquity. To tear down Hindu society in the spirit of the social reformers or European society in the spirit of the philosophical or unphilosophical anarchists would be to destroy order and substitute a licentious confusion. If we carefully remember these cautions, there's no harm in original thinking, even of the boldest and most merciless novelty. I may, for example, attack unsparingly the prevailing system of justice and punishment as extraordinarily senseless and evil. Even if I have no new system ready-made to put in it as its successor, but I must have no wish to destroy it, senseless and evil though it may be, until the new system is ready. For it fills a place, the vacancy of which the spirit that uplifts and supports our human welfare would greatly abhor. I may expose, too, the weaknesses and narrownesses of an existing form of religion, even if I have no new and better form to preach of my own. But I must not so rage against those weaknesses as to destroy all religious faith. And I should remember before the end of my criticism that even a bad religion is better than no religion, that it is wiser to worship energy in my surroundings with the African savage than to be dead to all faith and all spirituality, like the drunkards of a little knowledge. For even in that animal and unintelligent worship, there's a spark of the divine fire which keeps humanity living, while the cultured imperial Roman or the luxurious modern wealth gatherer and body worshipper drags his kind into a straight, well-built road which is so broad only to lead more easily to a mighty perdition. Otherwise, there is no harm in spreading dissatisfaction with fetish worship or refusing praise to an ancient and cruel folly. We need not be troubled if our thinking is condemned as too radical or even as reckless and revolutionary. For the success of a revolutionary thought always means that nature has need of one of her cataclysms. Even otherwise, she will never make of it whatever modified use is best for our present humanity. In thought, as in deeds, to the thinking we have a right. The result belongs to the wise and active power of God that stands over us and in us, originating, cherishing, indefatigably dissolving and remolding man and spirit in the progressive harmonies of his universe. Let us only strive that our light should be clear, diffused and steady, not either darkness or a narrow glare and merely violent luster. Now, if we cannot compass that ideal, still it is better to think than to cease from thinking. For even out of darkness, the day is born, and lightning has its uses. The truth. Has not the law expressly built up a hedge of technicalities to keep out the truth? As one looks on, one begins to understand the passion of the Roman poet's eulogy of the defense council, Praesidium Maestis Reis, the bulwark of the sorrowful accused. For in this strange civilized gambling with human dice, where it is so often impossible to be certain about guilt or innocence, one's sympathies naturally go to the sufferer, the scapegoat of a callous society, who may be moving to a long period of torturing and unmerited slavery or an undeserved death on the gallows. But if one could eliminate this element of human pity, it would be a real intellectual pleasure to watch the queer barbarous battle, appraise the methods of the chief players, admire, in whatever climes, the elusiveness and fine casualness of Indian perjury, or the robust, manly, cheery downrightness of Saxon cross-wearing. In the courts, if the courts convince us of our common humanity by making all men liars, they yet preserve a relishable unlikeness in likeness. And I think that even theology or metaphysics does not give such admirable chances for subtlety as the law, nor even Asiatic research or ethnology favors so much the growth of that admirable scientific faculty which deduces a whole animal out of some other animal's bone. If the thing proved is generally wrong, it is always ingenious. And after all, in all these five scientists, are they not rather arts, these scientists? It is not the thing that is true, but the thing that is desired which must be established. And this is perhaps why the Europeans think their system civilized. But as a semi-civilized Oriental, one would prefer less room for subtlety and more for truth. We'll close at this point for today and continue with another episode next week. Thank you for being here, for being with us, and may truth light your way this day. Bye for now.
This is Oroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.